Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This episode contains scenes which are not suitable for children and which some listeners may find distressing. This podcast is part of the Acast Creator Network.
I was back to run the business. It was more well run, it was more drugs involved, it was more quantity involved, it was more money involved. We went from selling 20 bags to 250 bags at a time, which is quite a lot if you're selling. If you sell 100 of them a day, at 250 quid. Do you know what I mean? It's a lot of money. Then we were selling ounces, we were selling bars, we were even selling kilos sometimes. And then the coke, we were knocking out one of our bags, 200 bags, quarters. The place had been completely revamped. The whole house had been revamped, security wise, all the electric fence, dogs on chains, cameras everywhere, lights everywhere. There was guns everywhere, brand new cars, a lot more. You could see there was a lot more money. The shed was full of stuff that we used to rob. There was trays of vodka. There was a lot more expensive things. I knew straight away what I was there for. I wasn't there to... for me to go and see Martin O'Hoyle and say sorry for doing something wrong. I was there to run the show and do his job for him. He felt like he'd hit the big time now. He'd met Thomas, got rid of Marlo, and he needed me. And he knew that. He knew I'd do it. Fortunately, it was probably the only thing I was good at. I knew how to sell drugs. And then it was just every day, 24 hours a day. Christmas Day, I was selling heroin. Now, 3 or 4 phones, never got any sleep, constantly giving me cocaine to keep me awake. I was going everywhere. I was going to Clondalkin. I was getting heroin slapped to me legs, to me bodies, around me chest. He'd bring me up, we'd pick boats up, we'd pick jeeps up off the ferry, and we'd bring the jeeps back to the shed and dismantle them and the whole jeep be full of drugs. It was just non-stop, it was just an operation. There was only me, him, Mandy, Mondo, the Umfla, in the house. He was only a Umfla. So I was looking after him. I was running the drug business. He had me upstairs bagging all the time. All I had in my bedroom was a bed, a table and a chair. 2 big weighing scales and bags. I had nothing else. That's when Henshin and his crew started coming over more. That's when we started knocking about with them.
This is the witness, in his own words. Episode 6, The Gun.
He idolised Henshin. Henshin had a good crew behind him in Clondalkin. They were violent, they were dangerous, they were murdering people. They were just ruthless. They were absolutely ruthless, like, and they were vicious. There was about 6 or 7 of them, and they used to come in convoy to Mitchell Sound College. And I mean, they'd all come in different cars. There'd be about 6 or 7 cars. They were into armed robbery as well. They were robbing factories, garages, shops, the same things. But there'd be guns in the boot, there'd be machetes. They were just, even when we were robbing places, there was just violence. Do you understand? These were just off our rocker. These were full of coke, full of smack. And they were just, like, when they were going, like, I remember going to Clondalkin in the car with them and Henschel and Brian and getting out and beating fellas up and all, like, and I mean a million of them, man, my shady crosses back, like blood everywhere, like I apparently chopped some fella's finger off and everything, like just they were just vicious, like, but they were big into shooting. They shoot you for nothing. But Brian and Thomas, they really got close, and they were literally always together then. Thomas was always in the house, or we were always over with Thomas. He definitely became Thomas's right-hand man. But Thomas was in charge. Thomas was he was the boss. He was the one to bring the drugs in. He had the context. But yeah, he was fascinated with Thomas. Fascinated with Thomas. Idolised him. And when Thomas did jump, he just jumped out. Like he just jumped. But once he started knocking about with Hench, he really got obsessed with Thomas. And Thomas liked him. And I think it was the first time he felt like he fitted in.
What did Thomas see in him?
I think Thomas seeing the evil in him. And that he would do anything that he asked him. I think he's seeing the evil, yeah. Have you ever looked at Thomas Henton's eyes? I look at him a lot. I can see him a lot. Pure evil. And that's what Kenny's. You look at the pictures you see in the paper. Just look at the two of them. That's evil. Like, I wake up at night to them pictures, like, in the middle of a pitch black room. I can just see them eyes looking at me. And that's what he's seeing. He's seeing evil. And he's seeing someone that would idolise them, that would do anything that you want them to do.
Do you think Brian was very aware that he was kind of considered like an outsider?
He was always an outsider because people didn't trust him. Everyone knew. Well, he claimed that he had friends in the guard, and he tried to use his alleged friends in the guards to help other gangsters get off of charges. That's what he would say. This was his story. And that's the reason that he was kept around. If that makes sense.
He thought he could be of use to them.
Yeah. So basically, the guard on one side, this is what he was saying. We're looking for information on Marlo, Bradley's, Hench, and all the crews from Dundalkin. So they felt like there was a need for Kenny. And also, I remember when he started telling these, I was there when he started telling these people that he had friends in the guards. And they were all just looking as if to say, like, I can't believe you just telling us this. And I remember the next day I used to say to him, you know what you said last night? Like, I remember telling Anto Spratt one night, he was up on a charge and we're all out in the shed, down the back, everyone's partying, Marlowe, everyone's there, sipping coke. I see the coke make you yap, make you talk shit. And a lot of people end up killed because of it. And I remember him saying to Anto Spratt, I might be able to help you out with that other thing you have coming up. And he was like, what do you mean help me out? He was like, I know somebody that might be able to do you a favour if you do a favour for them. And that's when the trouble started. That's when people started to see the other side. People started thinking, well, there's something not right there. And then people start saying it. People start calling him a rat and all, and that's when the problem started. That's when he got shot. In the middle of the night, about five blokes kicked the window in, the front windows in, and came in and shot him in the back. And he was lying down in the back garden, dying. But the blood pissing out his back. And then I had to get rid of all the drugs and the guns out of the house and hide them in the field and try and keep him alive while the ambulance came. He was lying on the ground. I'm keeping the stuff on him to stop the blood from pumping out of him. He would have died. So some people have said to me I should have let him die, but I'm just not that type of person, unfortunately. I remember going up to the hospital and he says to me, he was lying there in his silk pyjamas after being operated on. Same thing, all this fucking gangster shit, man, all these fucking velvet bleeding stuff and all, velvet pyjamas and all, slippers and everything. Like thinking he's like bleeding, Scarface or something. He was real nice, he was, in front of his man and all, they were all there, his family and all. And then when they left, he got me by the hand and called me over. He And he says, where's the gaunt and the jokes? I says, I put him in the field like you said. And he, I said, but I couldn't save all the jokes. He says, what do you mean you couldn't save them? I said, some of them got wet, like, because I had to, I couldn't wait because the police were coming. He was just being shot, like. And he says, I'm going to fucking kill you when I get you home. And I was like, I'm just after saving your life, like. But anyways, he got home. He was recovering in bed. And it was just straight back to business. I didn't realise Brian was smoking heroin until I moved back the second time. Until I been in my mouth. He wasn't smoking heroin before that. He was just big into coke and all. When I came back, he was a junkie. Like. Mm. He wasn't a junkie when I'd left. So he was smoking the heroin on tinfoil. Then he was rolling. He couldn't roll joints. I could roll joints. He used to get me to roll on joints and he'd pour heroin into the joints. And he'd smoke out of the joints as well. And then his habit just got worse then. Then they were shooting up then. That's when the needles start coming in. What we're going is he was going into town and all. He was going into this place. It was just off Gardner Street. And he was going in. He was getting loads of clean needles packed into them. And what, he'd leave them some in the room for Thomas. And then they'd have the belts on. And they'd be shooting up in the bedroom. And
Brian seems like someone who was all about control.
Yeah.
All the time. But then when he starts on the heroin, heroin's really about the opposite, right? Heroin's, you just lose control.
No, he got worse. He got OCD, he kept cleaning, it was like a military operation. Once he was, if he wasn't out, passed out, he was completely like a military operation. He got worse. That's the wrong way. He got the control when he was on the heroin was much worse than it was before. Like, literally, he'd make you sit at the dinner table for hours. You have to eat every bit off the plate. Like, you'd have to ask, could you go to the toilet? All these things happened after he started going on the heroin.
Do you think that was a reaction to maybe him being conscious that he wasn't always going to be in control if he was, you know, just passing out?
Like? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So when he was awake, when he was active, when he wasn't in the room smoking heroin or injecting heroin, he was barking out orders and constantly, never let, you know, he never stopped. The control got worse and worse. So it was just more of a military thing. He had the house clean. As I said, he wanted people to, on the outside, to think he was a gangster, a businessman, a professional. He wanted the people to look at him different. Nobody knew he was smoking heroin or injecting heroin in the bedroom. Only me, him, his wife, and the unflower, I don't know why he probably didn't even know they were there. So, and Henshin and stuff like that. So Henshin wasn't judging him because he was doing it. So you have to understand, the people we were hanging around with from Cundalkin were all doing the same thing. Where the Bradleys and Marlowe and all, they weren't users. They do cocaine and all, but they wouldn't be sticking heroin in there and like that. They would be too cute for that sort of stuff. Like, I have OCD and I know what OCD is. Once you start smoking the heroin, he was like, you had OCD. He was going around the house all the time, cleaning, washing windows. He had inspecting my bedroom, looking under the bed, seeing if there was a bit of dust. Like, obviously there was going to be dust. There was cocaine and bleeding heroin everywhere. And he'd be like, there's some coke on that. Like, what if the place gets raided and all? I'm like, the house is full of fucking drugs. In my head, I'm thinking, I'm not saying that to him. Oh, but in my head, I'm thinking, there's a shotgun downstairs, there's bleeding heroin, there's ounces of heroin in the room, the scales all over my room, my fingerprints are everywhere. And this was how crazy he got. He was just a lunatic. Like, everything had to be put away properly. The bed had to be made, like, not a crease in it. Like, it was just crazy. The paranoia just got unreal. The cameras, the walls being built bigger. I think after getting shot, I think he realised there was a price on his head. Like, we never had that many guns around the house before he was shot. Like, there was 3 or 4 guns in the house at one time. Like, we'd hand grenades, there was fucking pipe bombs in the field, the double-barrel shotguns, like, handguns, there was infrared bleeding goggles, stuff everywhere, like. But I think after getting shot and then realising the mistakes he'd made with Marlowe, he kind of thought, well, I'm not going to be that stupid this time with the henching crew, the Cadogan crew. He stopped using the so-called friends in the guard conversation, bringing that up. But all that was, I was told, never mention any of that in front of Thomas. We're in the big time now. Boom. And as I said to you, he had someone that accepted him, for finally met someone that accepted him on the level he wanted to be accepted. Yes, Thomas was supplying the heroin, but Thomas did kind of treat him as an equal, because they were both smoking heroin, they were both banging up heroin, they were both smackheads. They were both junkies, unfortunately. And that's a sad thing to say, but that's what they chose to do. And like his teeth fell out one day. I'll never forget it. He'd come screaming, he'd be like, Joey, come downstairs. I'm like, what's wrong? I come downstairs and he had a tooth in his hand. Like it's front tooth. I'm like, what's wrong? Like, and he's like, yeah, that's the fall on that one. I said, that's from the heroin, like, and he's like, oh, that, and he hit me across the face. He's like, you're judging me, I'm not a junkie, you know. I'm like, well, that's why I fell out, like. And do you know how he put it back in? I super glued it back into his mouth. And instead, stuck. Like, it was there when he got arrested, still. I got super glue. He was lying on the table. I put the super glue, shoved it back into his mouth, and instead, there. Like, on his wedding day, on that night, they spent the night in the car smoking heroin. Like, we were all in the pub, and I went out, like, and I was like, what are you doing? Like, and he's in the car, like, I'm like, everyone's asking, where are you? And he's sitting in the car, like, that's chasing the dragon, like, with the tinfoil to his mouth. And this was Tony Soprano, that was the biggest gangster in Dublin, and everyone else was a smackhead and a junkie, and everyone else was a rat, and he couldn't get his head around why someone shot him. But I think he was the only person that couldn't get his head around that everyone else could. I think even Mandy could. Like, when they were fighting and all, she used to be shouting, I wish they'd have killed you, I wish they'd never have saved your life. So, but yeah, we used to be sitting there looking at each other. He'd be running around the house, and when he'd be off with nothing to coke, he'd be getting emotional and all. And he'd be crying, he'd be saying, I don't understand why they want to kill me and all, what have I ever done to anybody? You've coppered every fucker on the fucking fingers. You're meant to be, one minute you're Tony Soprano and John Gilligan, the next minute you're fucking rattling every fucker on fingers and Ballymun and Blanchestown. Make your mind up. You're a gangster, you're a smackhead. He wanted to be both. To the outside world, he wanted to look like a proper businessman, proper professional, proper family man. He had the nice car, the nice home, the big gates, the cameras, the security lights, the nice, he had the arm candy at Mandy. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, everyone thought she was gorgeous. Like, to the outside world, that's what he wanted people to think. He was a businessman, and then he had connections, obviously, all the right connections with Marlowe, Hench, and all the gangsters. But really, behind them doors, behind the walls, it was just pure drug ridden kip. All that happened was people taking drugs, shooting up, sniffing coke, drinking, people being abused, people being beaten, or a me or a whore. And that's what it was. It was like hell behind that wall and behind them doors. It was just awful.
So that day, when, I mean, what's the first thing you remember about that day? When
them leaving. Yeah, I just remember them going. I remember being given some coke, and I was upstairs bagging in my room. I was bagging up heroin and coke, two scales. And the doors went in the shed, and most of the time they usually told me to lock the door behind me, but they didn't. And all I remember then was them coming back and shouting for me to go down, and I went down into the shed, and the two of them were standing there pulling the clothes off them, the letters off them, the helmets, all the gear, and washing themselves in the petrol and the tops of the petrol and the tops as well, I think they had, not like a paint stripper. And Brian told me to get the stuff and put it in the stove. We had the stove at the back where we used to sit around at night time. And I put the stuff in the stove and started burning it, and black smoke started coming from the top of it. And he started shouting at me, you're doing it wrong, you're doing it fucking wrong, stop doing it. And I was like, he told me to burn on, burn it. He said, yeah, but it's making black smoke. He said, the neighbours, the guards, I don't know why he said that, that's what he said. They were the words. So I threw water on top of it, got it all out, and I put in, I said to scrape it all out, and put it into a bag. Then they called me into the kitchen. They had me just going and wrapped in a bag. And said to me, go up to the field and hide it now. Get straight back. And he walked me out to the gate. So he basically walked me out to the field, really. But once I went through the ditch, he couldn't see. And usually I hid most of the guns around the fourth field, because they were easy to get to, in case that happened. In case there was trouble. There was something about, I just felt there was something wrong when he handed me the gun. And there was something telling me not to put it. Because if I'd have put it in the front field, I knew he would have found it. And I don't know whether I'd done it without thinking, or I kind of subconsciously not. I felt something was wrong. So for some reason, I put it in the second field, and I never put guns in the second field. Always cash and drugs in the second field. The guns are always in the front field in case someone started trouble at the house, so I could run and get a gun for them. That's how it worked. And when I hit it, I hit it right down a ditch, and I remember putting like little stones and like little twigs around it so I could remember where I was. Ran back to the house, and they told me they were after shooting somebody. Checked the teletext, and that's what we had back then, teletext. It went into his bedroom. I was just in shock, really, and I turned on the teletext and I said a man had been shot outside Cloverhill Prison, but I hadn't said he was dead. So I shouted in and I said, it says a man had been shot outside Cloverhill Prison, but didn't say he was dead. I could hear him saying in the kitchen, he was saying, what are we going to do if he's not dead? And they were panicking, they were all just like a heavy breathing, and they were just drinking and smoking and sniffing coke, and they were, what are we going to do? And then, I don't know which one, there was two teletexts, RT and TV3 at the time. And when I went on to the other one, I said, a man has died after being shot at Cloverhill Prison. And then once I shouted in and said that, I said a man has died after being shot at Cloverhill Prison, then it was just fucking horrendous. They were cheering, they were clapping, they were high-fiving each other. Thomas was saying, it's my playground now, Brian. I run Clondalkin and now I have it. This is my manor now, all this stuff and all. And Brian was saying, did you see him jumping around the car? Like, it was like a fish when I shot him. He was a big fella, wasn't he? I was just like, what the fuck? Like, that's happening. And he just told me out straight. He says, I'm after killing him. And he said, I'm after killing you, man. And I've done it once and I've no problem doing it again if you tell anybody. And then it just started. I was just standing in the kitchen and I was literally just sweat was pissing on me. I was shaking. They just kept saying, don't tell anybody. If you tell anybody, we're going to kill you, Joey. I'll blow your head off. I'll blow your mouth head off. Thomas never threatened me before. It's the first time he ever threatened me. Brian, I think he said something to me like, Thomas trusts you. And then Thomas said, sit down. And I sat down at the table and he says, I'm telling you now, Joey, if you tell anybody about this, I'll kill you and your family. Then I just didn't know what to do. I didn't know whether to leave the room. I didn't know whether I was allowed to leave the room. It was such an awkward situation. It was such an uncomfortable situation. I didn't know whether I was there to walk away. I didn't know whether to stand in the one spot. Then they started giving me a drink. Then they were like sniffling a coke. And it was just adrenaline then running through my body. And then they started banging up then. They started fucking shooting up heroin and all. And then they were all falling asleep and goofing off. And then the phone started ringing, the work phone. I went upstairs, lying on the bed. I was lying on the bed and I was just staring at the scene. I was thinking, what am I going to do? I didn't know what to do. I was thinking about your man. I didn't know what Jonathan looked like. So I was trying to imagine in my head what he looked like. So everything was just kind of running through my head. I didn't know what was happening. And I was just kind of... yeah, I was just kind of in shock for a few days. He took me out to the shed that night. Battered me and abused me. I think he's done that to frighten me though. I think that was kind of a warning. Just to let me know, like. Yeah, that's when it just started getting, everything went really bad then. Like, everything that had happened before then had happened 10 times worse. All I could think about was Jonathan dying. And then I just thought, I'd accepted, I just thought, I'm either going to die, they're either going to kill me. I thought, there's no way they're going to let me use this, keep this secret. Like, there's no way they're going to let me walk out of here alive. Or let me go back to my ma's, or let me ever leave them, knowing the secret. I just couldn't picture it. And I kind of thought in my head, every person I've met, Marlo, Fatpuss, all of them, none of them would let me walk away. Being that young and being... I just couldn't, in my head I was thinking, there's no way anyone would let me walk away. So I just accepted that I was either going to die, they're either going to kill me, or I was either going to kill myself with the drugs, like, so. Yeah, everything just got changed then. Everything just got real nasty. He was trying to control every aspect of my life. That was it then, that's when I thought I needed to get out of here. And that's when I made the plan.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.